Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the criminal complaint filed in federal court on Tuesday, in which the alleged New Jersey bomber Ahmad Khan Rahami was charged with the use of weapons of mass destruction and, according to his blood-spattered bullet-holed journal, was inspired by brother Osama bin Laden and the American jihadist Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed by a drone strike in Yemen. David Shanza, professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security at the School of Public Policy at Duke University, joins us to address criticism leveled at the FBI following the shootout and capture of the bombing suspect in New Jersey, whose father was concerned his son was a terrorist, which, like the earlier case involving the father of the Orlando shooter, prompted the FBI to investigate these potential terrorists before closing the cases for lack of evidence. We will also analyze Donald Trump's bombastic anti-terrorism proposals that will make it all but impossible to identify and interdict homegrown terrorists in the future, such as Rahami, Orlando's Mateen, the San Bernardino terrorists, and the Boston bombers. Then we'll examine calls by Donald Trump to deny Ahmad Khan Rahami medical treatment and legal representation, and a request from Senator Lindsey Graham to the Obama administration to deny the alleged terrorist due process under the law and have him labeled as an enemy combatant. Stephen Vladeck, a professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law, a Supreme Court analyst for CNN, and the co-editor-in-chief of the Just Security blog, joins us to discuss the hysteria over domestic terrorism that Trump is generating in this election and the danger of changing the law to go after the, quote, not yet guilty, which would be, as Ben Franklin warned the likes of Donald Trump, that, quote, he who would trade liberty for temporary security deserves neither. Then finally, we will look into today's impeachment hearing in the House, called to placate the Tea Party Freedom Caucus, who are using the threat of impeaching the IRS Commissioner John Koskinen to block any effort to reform IRS rules that allow unlimited and unattributed dark money into our elections under the loophole of a 501c4 social welfare tax exemption. Emily Patterson Casson, Project Director of the Bright Lines Project at Public Citizen, joins us to discuss today's hearings, at which Democrats turned the tables on the Republicans and used the hearing to get the head of the IRS to debunk Donald Trump's excuse for not releasing his tax returns to the public. Joining us now is David Shanza, Associate Professor of the Practice and the Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously was a Democratic Staff Director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as a Legislative Director for Senator Jeanne Carnahan, Counsel to Senator Joseph Biden, and Counsel to Senator William Cohen. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Shanza.
Well, thank you for having me.
And what is going on with this sort of, there's some criticism of the FBI's handling of the New Jersey bombing case, in as much as it's been revealed that the father at one point told the FBI they thought his son was a terrorist. And that, of course, has echoes of what happened with the Orlando shooter, whose father similarly turned him in, or didn't, or at least alerted the FBI to his concerns. In both cases, of course, nothing happened. Are we to conclude that there's a problem here with FBI counterterrorism?
Well, first of all, it's not true that nothing happened with the Mateen case, because there were warrants that were issued, there was intelligence, there was surveillance that took place over a lengthy period of time. In the end, if you don't have evidence that a crime was committed, then at some point, there's nothing you can do and you have to close the case. In this instance, I mean, we're still learning the facts and the details, but I think there's really nothing easier than moving backwards from an incident and looking to see all the different clues that could have possibly been missed, or leads that could have been continued to pursue for a matter of years, you know, and then saying to the intelligence or the law enforcement agency that, well, you failed. It's much different if you're looking from the perspective of where we are and you have 1,000 different leads, and then you have to investigate them all and then decide which ones are to be pursued. So that's a much more difficult task, and that's the one that the FBI faces every day.
So this territory has been described as the not yet guilty territory, and it does raise, of course, lots of civil liberties questions. And in the case then of the Orlando shooter, did it come down to the fact that they had him under expensive surveillance for a while and they simply couldn't find enough to proceed and they closed the case? Is this about expense and resources?
Well, there's two things. There's expense and resources, and yes, you can't surveil everyone that you get a tip from, because first of all, not all tips turn out to be accurate. Sometimes people have agendas they're pursuing, which is why they turn people into law enforcement. Obviously, this was a father who was turning in his own son, so that has actually a large amount of credibility. But there's also the rules of living in a democracy is that we don't live in a constant surveillance state, and there are certain standards that have to be met in order to give the government the power to conduct intrusive surveillance on someone. So you can have information and you can conduct the surveillance, but ultimately if you don't have information to show that the person is involved in a terrorist group, and that was the question with Mateen, did he have some sort of connection to an international terrorist organization, or had he broken any laws, or was there evidence that he was about to break any laws? Those are the standards for the Fourth Amendment, and they apply across the board, even in an intelligence context. So if they're not met in a democracy, we don't want to have a permanent surveillance state with unmitigated powers to conduct surveillance on, I don't agree with this, not yet guilty. A lot of the people who fall under scrutiny are actually innocent. Probably a large majority of the tips they get are people who never end up breaking the law.
But then what about the other factor, David Shanzer, of the trips to Pakistan that also came up in the San Bernardino bombers, particularly the wife, who both was traveled to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan? What kind of flagging goes on there? Because the FBI, I think, have assumed that this Ahmed Khan Rahmani was actually fairly sophisticated in his bomb making and seemed to have gotten some training. And I think he spent about a year in Pakistan for one stretch. And that's certainly, that country is just full of terrorist training grounds, because it's actually the government's policy in a way to use terrorism under the nuclear umbrella as a hedge against their perception that India is a more powerful military neighbor.
Well, there's a lot of issues there, but and first of all, I'm not defending the FBI's handling of this particular case with the pipe bomber, because I don't know all the facts and I don't know all the investigative materials, so it's impossible to evaluate based on snippets. I don't think you have it entirely right with the wife of the San Bernardino, one of the San Bernardino bombers, because she had spent time in Pakistan and Saudi Arabia before emigrating to the United States. It wasn't a trip, and I don't think she was under an FBI investigation. She was, the question was whether she was properly issued a visa, which wouldn't be an FBI issue, it would be a Homeland Security one. But putting all that aside, yes, foreign travel, and I think this is more similar to the Boston Marathon bombing case, where you had an individual who had come under some suspicion and then had engaged in foreign travel. And those are people who should have a lot of law enforcement, investigative, and intelligence resources directed at them. And it's certainly fair questions to ask whether sufficient probing was done as to what this person did in Afghanistan. And I think those are questions that the FBI is going to have to answer. I agree with you. Foreign travel connected with an allegation by someone, his own father in the United States, that's a fair issue.
So in the broader sense, though, David Shanzer, is there a problem with the FBI, since it's primarily a law enforcement agency, And it's done counterterrorism because of the division between domestic and foreign, where the CIA operates abroad and the FBI operates domestically. They have done counterintelligence, and they did counterintelligence during the Cold War here in the United States. But are they up to the task? There's a big difference between law enforcement, which is going after crimes that are already committed, and intelligence that it is preventing crimes from being committed.
Sure. Well, counterintelligence is actually trying to prevent people who are spying on you. But intelligence collection, we had a debate about this after 9/11. Did we want to go to a system like in the UK, where we had a domestic intelligence agency that was separate and apart? And the FBI argued vociferously against that, as did many civil libertarians. That's in many ways against our national DNA to have a agency, an entire part of the government dedicated towards spying on its own citizens. So we have never had that in the U.S., but the FBI, I think, has really increased its capabilities and a lot of resources poured into it. Of course, every time there is a particular individual that successfully executes an attack, we look backwards and say, well, that must be means that the FBI is falling flat on the job. But if you look at, all the different individuals who have been preempted, the arrests that have taken place, and the small volume, it sometimes seems like a lot, but the small volume of terrorism connected with Al-Qaeda and ISIS that we've had in this country over the past 15 years, the number of deaths from these incidents is about a weekend worth of the number of homicides that we have in America every single weekend for the past 15 years. It is a small quantum of violence. We can't continue to have a free society. We can't continue to have a government that is of limited powers and expect to drive that number all the way down to zero. There are resource constraints and legal constraints. All in all, I think if you assess the past decade and a half, the FBI has done a pretty darn good job keeping it safe.
Well, of course, it is an election year, and it has become an election issue. Donald Trump seized on this and in a way is sort of crowing about "I told you so" in regard to this latest bombing and also the stabbing in Minnesota. And it does seem, I've spoken with John Mueller at Ohio State University, who has often argued that this whole war on terror has become a massive boondoggle, and points out that you have a greater chance of being struck by lightning or hit by a meteor than you have of being killed by a terrorist. But at the best of times, it doesn't seem that the American public is receptive to that kind of proportionality. And the media, I don't think, helps, because they beat the drum like crazy. And of course, on top of that, Donald Trump is stirring the pot and fueling the fire. So do we just have to accept this level of induced paranoia?
We can try to have good discussions like we're having now. I don't fully agree with Mueller, who wouldn't even agree with the amount of level of resources and effort that the FBI is putting into doing. He would say that is a step too far, and I would disagree with that. I think because of the demands of the public and demands of the political nature of this, that we do need to put that level of resources and drive this level of violence from this particular source as close to zero as possible. I just don't think we should say there's systemic failure every time an incident occurs. If you live in a free society where people can buy weapons, matter of fact, many of the Trump supporters will be the first ones to say that people should have the freedom to buy weapons, to buy explosives, if you live in that kind of society, stopping them and finding and predicting exactly who of our massive population is going to use these freedoms and abuse them for these purposes, you know, it's not possible to be entirely perfect. We want to have a free society. You have to bear some level of risk. And that is unfortunately, you know, what happens. I don't understand Trump's argument that he didn't foresee anything. He didn't identify that this particular person at this particular moment was going to engage in an act of political violence. He didn't do anything. And that's what we're asking the FBI to do, which is to look at the entire population and figure out which of these individuals, based on the information that can be gathered, is actually going to perpetrate an act of violence. That's a very, very hard thing to do.
But there is a kind of pattern here, you know, going back to the shoe bomber, to the Times Square bomber, and this particular bomber in New Jersey did appear to have, at least the FBI, I think he had some sophisticated bomb training or the manufacturing of bombs, etc. But he was able to buy a bunch of stuff, as you mentioned, everything's available off the shelf. But given how much information's coming out now about his writings, his following al-Awlaki, the American who was killed by a drone in Yemen, who's been an inspiration along with Osama bin Laden, both of whom Ahmed Khan Rahmani praised and pledged fealty to. But in general, there seems to be a kind of pattern here that suggests to me that we're just going to have to accept that there's going to be this low-level kind of activity from these loners for I don't know how long, but is this something that we're going to have to deal with rather than pretend that there's some magic bullet? Now, I understand that there's going to be a major offensive in October against the Islamic State, and you know, maybe the problem will be in part solved at its source. But do you accept the premise that there's no sort of leak-proof formula here, and that these kind of characters like Ahmed Khan Rahmani, they're going to crop up every now and then?
Well, first of all, he seems to have been inspired by al-Qaeda-affiliated entities, which have been with us prior to 9/11 and have not been eliminated. So he does not seem to have been a fanboy of the Islamic State. So, and I also, you know, reject the idea that, you know, somehow an offensive against ISIS, even if they lose all their territory in Iraq and Syria, will somehow eliminate this ideology, these senses of grievances. These have deep historic roots. They arise out of a incredibly dysfunctional political situation in the Middle East, especially in Iraq and Syria, which are countries right now racked by civil war and conflict. Those kinds of conflicts, Iraq under five wars over a 20-year period, those kinds of conflicts spawn spillover effects. They anger certain individuals who seek revenge. They seek identification. They seek some sort of connection and the feeling that they must do something to try to respond to violence against people that they identify with. This individual, the war in Afghanistan, going on for 15 years. There's been civil war in Afghanistan for decades. So that's going to create anger among individuals that is going to manifest itself in many unpredictable ways. I reject the idea that there is some sort of pattern here that was in some ways predictable, but I do think that you're right, that yes, we are going to have some form of political violence that spills over into our nation from these many conflicts abroad. I think it is manageable. I think it's an amount right now that we can deal with in society. I think the fact that we've stopped any sort of these groups from doing anything on the scale or even a one or two order to, of magnitude of the size of 9/11 is actually very successful. We have pushed this down to the level of individuals who don't have very much funding, maybe a little bit of training, things that they learn on the internet. Small numbers of people can do a lot of damage. They can harm people, but I don't think they can, you know, damage our incredible nation. They can cause damage, and it is frightening. But I think we should try to keep it in perspective and keep it in proportion.
Well, just in closing, though, David Chanza, everything that you've said flies in the face of these bragging promises that Donald Trump is putting forth, that somehow he's going to do it better and end this problem.
All of Trump's policies are going to make each one of these problems worse. And there's no doubt in my mind that is the case. He says he's going to eliminate ISIS and going to go at them hard. There is only one way to do that, and that is with the insertion of huge numbers of U.S. troops into Syria and Iraq to obliterate this group. And that is what he has promised to do. To my mind, that is going to be the Iraq war all over again, where you'll have U.S. troops occupying a traditional Muslim territory in an area with no governance and no stability, and is going to lead to a huge amount of blowback against us, first in the region and then blowback around, reverberating around the world. Remember the so-called, the dead-enders. Well, they happen to be an insurgency that ultimately led to the creation of ISIS. So that is a prescription, in my mind, for disaster. ISIS's worst nightmare is when Muslims are fighting against them, not when they are pining for a moment to have an invasion of so-called infidels that they can try to rally their supporters for, and that would be horrible. And then his prescriptions for what to do domestically are 100% wrong on how to stop this form of violence. The best way to stop this, and it happened here, it's just unfortunately all the clues didn't get picked up, but it's to encourage family, friends, associates to keep, to be sensitive to telltale signs, changes in behavior, and things of that nature, and bring them to the attention of law enforcement. Trump's policies, which would have overt religious discrimination, which would allow surveillance on people based on how they pray to God, not based on whether there's criminal behavior, would push people underground, would make them more scared, would single them out for government unfair treatment. That's not the way to encourage more tips and clues for communities about these individuals who are very, very hard to catch. So I think that the Trump policy prescriptions will make us less safe, will we have more terrorism, and will harm our nation in many, many different ways.
Well, David Chanza, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Chanza, who's a professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center of Terrorism and Homeland Security at the School of Public Policy at Duke University. Previously, he was the Democratic Staff Director for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security and served as a legislative director for Senator Gene Carnahan, counsel to Senator Joseph Biden, and counsel to Senator William Cohen. His positions in the executive branch include special counsel to the Office of the General Counsel at the Department of Defense and trial attorney for the United States Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the theatrics surrounding the hearings today in the House to impeach the commissioner of the IRS. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Stephen Vladeck, who's a professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law, a Supreme Court analyst for CNN, and co-editor-in-chief of the Just Security blog. A nationally recognized expert on the role of the federal courts in the war on terrorism, his work has appeared in the Harvard Law Review and the Yale Law Journal. And his writing has appeared in publications ranging from the New York Times to BuzzFeed. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Vladeck.
Thanks for having me.
And obviously Donald Trump is beating the drum about the I told you so about the New Jersey bomber. And now we have Senator Lindsey Graham stepping forth and telling the Obama administration that they should basically not treat the suspect Ahmed Khan Rahmani in the several bomb plots who was shot by the police, not to treat him as a, in other words, try him in the American courts and give him the benefits of due process, but rather he should be labeled as a enemy combatant. And it seems rather blithe that these kind of suggestions are being made, which would be a gross violation of the U.S. Constitution, because my understanding is that even if you're not born here in the United States, you're still covered by the laws of the land, and you're protected by the U.S. Constitution.
Indeed. Well, and I think, I mean, the critical point for this conversation is that, you know, Rahmani is not alleged to be tied to al-Qaeda or ISIS. The reason why that matters is there's actually a statute that's been on the books in the United States since 1971 called the Non-Detention Act. And the Non-Detention Act basically says that citizens cannot be detained unless pursuant to an act of Congress. Well, there's no act of Congress that allows for the general military detention of anyone who we believe is a terrorism suspect. There's a more specific act of Congress, the one Congress passed 1 week after the 9/11 attacks, which applies to individuals who are part of al-Qaeda, but without some kind of connection to al-Qaeda or ISIS or one of those other major terrorist groups, there's just no authority to hold someone like Rahmani in military detention, even if we thought it was a good idea.
So what explains this sort of beating of the drum that's going on? Even CNN is joining in the chorus to throw the book at this guy.
Well, I think it's a knee-jerk reaction born out of fear. I mean, I think there's a sense that, you know, the threat posed by these kinds of terrorist episodes is so great that it just must be the case that our ordinary civil courts and our ordinary criminal prosecutions aren't enough to handle these kinds of individuals. And the problem is that's just not true. And not only is it not true, but we now have 15 years of evidence of just how well the civilian courts have been able to handle terrorism cases and just how unsignificant the concerns that someone like Senator Graham, someone like Mr. Trump have raised about being able to interrogate this kind of suspect turn out to be. You know, there's lots of room in the law for the government to lawfully interrogate terrorism suspects without reading them in their Miranda rights, to obtain intelligence information to ensure there is no ongoing threat to public safety and national security, and then to still prosecute the suspect in the ordinary civilian court. So there's just no need for this kind of a hyperbolic reaction, even if it were legal, to do the things that Senator Graham and Mr. Trump are contemplating.
Well, of course, Donald Trump has taken it further. He was lamenting that Rahmani was given medical treatment after the shootout with the police and was critical of the fact that he's entitled to a lawyer provided by the federal government to defend himself. So obviously we're in this political season, but there's also it's a political season which is particularly focused on paranoia. You've got Donald Trump's son likening Syrian refugees to a bowl of Skittles in which two or three of the candies are poisonous, etc. Is there any way to extract the politics from this, or is this just something that we have to endure as a temporary assault on American values that is not necessarily going to last?
I mean, I don't think there's ever a way to extract the politics from this. I mean, I think, you know, especially when there's a Democratic president in office and or, you know, a forthcoming and impending political campaign, I think it's long been the MO of the Republican Party to try to capitalize upon fear, to try to suggest that, you know, we're better off with Republican candidates and Republican presidents because they will be tougher on these kinds of issues. And I think that's just a non sequitur, right? I mean, I don't know that, you know, subjecting someone to military as opposed to civilian process necessarily is a better solution. I mean, just look at how long it has taken for the military commissions at Guantanamo to get off the ground. We're 15 years in, there have been 7 trials, and the trial of the major 9/11 defendants is mired in pretrial delays. It might not happen until 2024. So, you know, I think this whole conversation has at its core something that's just not true, which is the belief that the military process is somehow better suited to keeping us safe. We haven't needed that. The civilian courts have been able to incapacitate hundreds of terrorism suspects over the last 15 years. And so until and unless the folks who are actually on the ground doing the work for our intelligence agencies, for our national security apparatus, are saying that they don't have the tools they need, I think it's more than a little bit of chutzpah for someone like Donald Trump, for someone like Lindsey Graham, to say that the existing tools are insufficient, that we should go back to what we did in the early days after 9/11, which we now know was such an overreaction and an unnecessary one at that.
So is there then, in this sort of world of political paranoia, any way that somebody like a Hillary Clinton, who was a little bit flat-footed, initially the law enforcement officials were loath to connect the bombings in New York and then later in New Jersey to terrorism, and eventually they had to admit it. But there's such an obvious pattern here that goes back to all of these, Orlando shooter, the Tennessee shooter, etc., that they're, you know, that they're sort of homegrown, influenced over the internet. In this case, this character had gone to spent quite a bit of time in Pakistan, where he may well have been trained in how to make bombs, because the FBI said these bombs are relatively sophisticated. So it seems to me that the mature way to deal with this is to recognize that this is a phenomenon of low-intensity warfare, and that we do have the potential of these sort of self-taught, self-radicalized loners to be a kind of drip, drip, drip in our society in terms of these minor terrorist acts. But the overall context is, of course, that you have a greater chance of being struck by lightning or hit by a meteorite than you have of being killed by a terrorist.
Well, I think that's the real problem here, right, which is that, you know, no one denies that terrorism is a real threat, and that it's a serious issue, and it's one that we should take seriously, and that one we should sort of think long and hard about. But, you know, is it such a grave threat, especially this scale of attack, that we're willing to sacrifice some of the most fundamental civil liberties, some of the most fundamental things about being an American, right? I mean, the Supreme Court once said it would be ironic if in the name of national security, we would sacrifice those liberties that make securing the nation worthwhile, right? And that's the tension here. And so, you know, I think the real conversation we should be having is the government doing enough on the front end? Is the government doing all it can on the front end to figure out, you know, who are the individuals most susceptible to being radicalized, to tracking them, to using all lawful means of, you know, conducting surveillance? That's a front-end conversation, and it's one we ought to have. To have this sort of reactionary, once you have someone like this, we should just throw them away in Guantanamo and lock the key and throw away the key, is, I think, completely counterproductive and unnecessary. And it belies the real conversation we ought to be having about the government's ability to stop these attacks before they happen, to preempt them, to disrupt these networks, and so on and so forth. And so, you know, I think it's sort of a pox on everyone's houses for focusing on how to close the barn door after the animals have gotten out, as opposed to the real conversation, which is, you know, is the government doing all it can on the investigative and surveillance end, on the prevention side of these attacks?
Well, but it's not as if these terrorists, going back to the shoe bomber and the Times Square bomber, and just about all of them, really, except, of course, for the deadly Orlando attack, which had a lot to do with the inability of the police to get in there or the reluctance, and that's why most people died. But in general, they advertise themselves in two cases, in Orlando and in this current case in New Jersey. The parents even tipped off the FBI that they were concerned about their son's terrorist leanings. and they publicize stuff, they write stuff down. They're sort of, you know, amateurs openly motivated by this poisonous stuff that they get from the Islamic State via the internet. But as a law enforcement matter, these are not Einsteins.
True, but I guess the question then arises, right, at what point have these individuals actually crossed the line from those who we want to keep an eye on to criminals? It's easier, actually, when you have someone who is more clearly affiliated with a group like Al-Qaeda, because we have criminal laws that make it a crime simply to provide support to these kinds of designated terrorist groups. The problem with the lone wolf is that it's pretty darn late in the process toward planning an attack when the lone wolf actually breaks the law for the first time. And so from the government's perspective, yes, they can watch these folks. They can, you know, monitor social media. They can do, you know, the full extent of investigations that the Constitution allows. But where lone wolves are concerned, as opposed to, you know, Al-Qaeda cells or ISIS networks, the law is not as, how do I say this, punitive and restrictive, and it comes into play a little further down the pipeline. And so maybe that's the conversation we ought to be having as a society, is should we be allowing the government to interdict these individuals earlier on when they haven't done anything other than post some ominous things online or read some of the wrong manuals or said things that, you know, ring a bell the wrong way. That's where we get to the fundamental questions about which values are too important to us as Americans to sacrifice in the name of, you know, preempting these kinds of attacks. And that's a conversation we ought to be having. It's just not a conversation that either of the presidential candidates seem to want to have, and for that matter, the media as well.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, obviously you're dealing with a very touchy issue, which is the not yet guilty. And that is a really slippery slope that scares the hell out of me, frankly. How do you determine the not yet guilty, whether they're guilty?
Well, that's and that's the conversation, right? So, you know, this isn't exactly the, you know, Tom Cruise movie Minority Report, where we have these, you know, individuals who can see crime before they happen. And so the question we need to ask, the conversation we need to be having in homes across this country, in community meetings across this country, in legislatures across this country, is where is the line between speech that we don't like, between, you know, sort of early on preparatory actions that look ominous but aren't actually illegal, and episodes like these, you know, pipe bomb attacks in New York and New Jersey. The line, you know, exists, but I think law enforcement folks would tell you that where you have lone wolves especially, the line is pretty far along in the process. Are we really comfortable with moving the line earlier, where someone could be arrested and thrown in jail for years because they said the wrong thing online? That has not historically been who we are as a country. It hasn't historically been how we understand our Constitution. And I think it would be a very slippery slope to go down that road. But that's the problem, and that's the tension raised by these cases.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Stephen Vladeck.
Thank you.
And we've been speaking with Stephen Vladeck, who's a professor of law at the University of Texas School of Law, a Supreme Court analyst for CNN, and the co-editor-in-chief of the Just Security blog, a nationally recognized expert on the role of the federal courts in the war on terrorism. His work has appeared in the Harvard Law Review and the Yale Law Journal, and his writing has appeared in publications ranging from the New York Times to BuzzFeed. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into attempts by Donald Trump and Senator Lindsey Graham to label the terrorism suspect in New Jersey as an enemy combatant.
To the IRA. Headline!
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Emily Peterson-Casson, who is a project coordinator of the Bright Lines Project at Public Citizen and an attorney who has worked in ERISA, retirement and pension litigation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Emily Peterson-Casson.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And you spent your day today at the hearing in the Congress where the House Republicans, or specifically the Freedom Caucus, the Tea Party wing, forced this hearing. Or actually, the hearing was a compromise because they were going to force an impeachment vote on the floor. And I take it that the idea was to call for the impeachment of the IRS Commissioner, John Koskinen. However, did not some of the Democratic House members use this as an occasion to call for Donald Trump to release his taxes, ask very pertinent questions to the IRS commissioner about Trump's excuses for not releasing his taxes? And I take it one of the congressmen was munching on a bowl of Skittles.
That's exactly right. I believe it was a bag of Skittles. But all of this goes back to, you know, years ago when the IRS was using inappropriate criteria to identify some nonprofits who were applying for nonprofit status for further scrutiny. And the thing is, there is a solution to that that is on the table, that has been on the table since this all came to light, which is to put new rules in place for nonprofit political activity, rules that would make sense. And this same Congress that's calling for John Koskinen's impeachment stopped those rules from going forward in December with an inappropriate rider to a spending bill. And so instead of having any solutions or talking about this in a nonpartisan or even a bipartisan way, as they certainly could, this hearing just turned into a complete sideshow. And all of this impeachment talk has been just a partisan play when, in fact, there are real solutions that are out there that are not getting discussed at all.
But going back to the original sin, for the want of a better description, of the IRS looking into these dark money vehicles that have dominated our politics, where billionaires can give money through these IRS vehicles known as social welfare vehicles without their names and the amounts, I believe. Not only the names are not released to the public, neither are the amounts. And this has become a favorite tool because one of the things that regulated political spending in this country was that big corporations, for example, didn't want to be publicly identified with partisan politics because half their customers are Republicans and half their customers are Democrats. So it's proven to be a catastrophe in terms of moneyed influence in our politics. And as far as I know, the IRS basically put in a few words into a sort of search algorithm. One of them was Tea Party, but I believe they also put in words that would indicate liberal donor groups as well. And this has driven these Tea Party people crazy in the Congress.
Yeah.
And on top of that, a couple of IRS employees destroyed a bunch of tapes, which were interpreted as being some cover-up, even though there have been investigations by the Treasury Department's Inspector General, the Justice Department, and the Senate Finance Committee that concluded that the IRS Commissioner Koskinen did not attempt to obstruct congressional investigations in any way. So, is that correct?
Yep, you're totally right. And you've touched on a lot of things here that I'll just go through briefly. So what happened was there was a list of names of organizations, that words and names that were selected for further scrutiny, and those did include both progressive, the word progressive, for example, some words that were on the kind of, you would think, more liberal side of the scale, and words that were on the more conservative side of the scale, like Tea Party, 912, that kind of thing. And the reason that happened is that the rules right now, so if you're a nonprofit, you can only do so much political activity. And the rules right now governing what you can and can't do, what doesn't count as political activity, are so vague that it's allowed a lot of groups who want to abuse the system to go forward with no IRS enforcement. And so the IRS, even when deciding who does and doesn't qualify, doesn't have anything to go on because these rules are so vague. And so, as you mentioned, after Citizens United, this opened up a huge way of using nonprofits that didn't exist before, that didn't exist when Congress, was conceiving of how nonprofits should be run, which is that a social welfare organization like a 501c4 can spend up to about 49% of its resources on politics without disclosing any of its donors or how much they've given, including corporate donors. So all of a sudden, after Citizens United, this has become a major vehicle for folks that want to spend money on elections, that don't want their names disclosed to voters, that don't want the voters to know where this money is coming from. And that's not how nonprofits were intended to operate, but it's because of these vague, bad rules and because of Citizens United, it's how they're operating in the current conditions.
And again, I'm speaking with Emily Peterson-Casson, project coordinator of the Bright Lines Project at Public Citizen and an attorney who has worked in ERISA retirement and pension litigation. But surely there is another way to look at this, Emily, and that is that this is just the Republicans playing hardball and bullying by threatening to impeach the IRS commissioner. They put a lot of pressure and leverage on him not to touch this issue at all, not to go ahead and reform this flagrant breach of the public trust in terms of this gaping loophole that's allowed all of this dark money to pour into our politics. That's their real strategy, surely. They don't want this gravy train to end. So they're just applying pressure in the name of some mythical infraction on the part of the IRS commissioner about destroying tapes and covering up something that's been investigated to death and didn't happen. Surely
right.
That's what's going on here, isn't it? This is just bullying politics to put this poor guy at the IRS, just to put him in a situation where he's simply incapable of doing his job, and the very last thing he can do is go after these people because they're intimidating him.
Well, I think, you know, the IRS has, and the Treasury Department too, have undertaken a whole slew of reforms to address the circumstances that led to this targeting that took place years and years ago. And every investigation found, just exactly as you said, every investigation found there's no partisanship. It was just really bad decision making. But the one thing that they can't do is make new rules. And that's the thing that we really need them to do. And the reason they can't do it is because Congress stopped them. And, you know, this was bargained away as a little inappropriate provision on a spending bill to stop this rulemaking that could make sure that some of this money right now that's being spent on politics would go to appropriate places that do disclose their donors and wouldn't be dark money anymore. And that was important enough, apparently, for Republicans in Congress to stop it. So, I mean, you can draw whatever conclusion you like from that, I suppose.
Right. The fact that they want the status quo to continue, mm-hmm. which allows them an enormous advantage because most billionaires who don't want their names and amounts attributed to their donations tend to vote Republican or support Republican candidates. I think that's pretty clear. So mm-hmm. that's my conclusion. I think it's pretty evident that that's what this is all about. So let's turn to today's theatrics then. And as I mentioned, Congressman Gutierrez had a bag of Skittles, obviously a dig at Donald Trump Jr.'s tasteless remark about a bowl of Skittles being three of which are poisonous and therefore you can't let the Syrian refugees in. That was clearly what he was getting at. But didn't a bunch of the Democratic Congress people as well take advantage, including Gerald Nadler, of the situation to really turn the tables on the Republicans and question why Donald Trump has not released his tax returns and asked the IRS commissioner directly whether the excuse that Trump has given, which is that you can't release your returns while you're being audited, was completely blown out of the water, was it not?
Yeah, that was a strong piece of their narrative. And I thought it was sad. You know, I thought it was that this was a hearing where we could have been discussing bright line solutions to problems that nonprofits have been having for decades. And instead of that, you know, it was already a partisan hearing because the Republicans are just there to beat up on John Koskinen, who has been proven again and again and again to not have been involved with anything that he's been accused of. And instead of, I would say, taking the high road and talking about these real solutions, Democrats used it to talk about Donald Trump and his tax returns and all of the problems he's had with his charities. And I think in this election, nonprofits they really face risk because the nonpartisanship of the nonprofit sector is something that needs to be preserved and defended. And here we have this situation where we have these bad actor 501c4s funneling a ton of money into our elections improperly. That's not social welfare. And at the same time, you know, groups like the Trump Foundation using their allegedly charitable money for self-dealing for their, you know, main proprietor. It's tough. It's a tough situation for the vast, vast majority of nonprofits who are just out there to fulfill their missions and do their charitable work without getting involved in politics.
Yeah, but nobody's going after them, as far as I know. At least I can't imagine why the IRS would be going after legitimate nonprofits if they're not going after the flagrant abuse of Donald Trump with his self-serving charity, where he gets charitable gifts, which he then turns around and spends on himself in the name of his own foundation, which is a way to make himself look charitable when, in fact, he's dispensing other people's money for his own benefit.
Yeah, it's true. And the IRS Enforcement Division, it's called the Exempt Organizations Division, has really been hurt by the billions of dollars of budget cuts that the IRS has received over the past 6 years at the hands of this Congress. And not having, so the Exempt Organizations unit doesn't bring in taxes. And so it's kind of a heavy lift to get them to enforce anything, because that enforcement is not going to bring in more money for the IRS. So in a time of decreased resources, that's the type of stuff that goes by the wayside. And it leads to terrible situations like this where enforcement is just not enough.
But on the other count that the Democrats were using, questioning the IRS commissioner, or taking advantage of this hearing to question the IRS commissioner about why Donald Trump had not filed his tax returns and was not making them public, which is what all presidential candidates have done for several decades now. The Trump excuse is that it's under audit. They were able to expose that by having the IRS commissioner say, well, that's not true. You can still release them even if they're under audit. But it seems to me that what Trump is hiding, and most people seem to agree on this, is the fact that he doesn't pay any income tax because he's in real estate. So is there ever going to be a discussion about the real issues, I think, that should be dealt with the IRS, is how come so many people get these incredible loopholes, not just the dark money loopholes in the 501c4, but, you know, these real estate loopholes that allow this alleged multi-billionaire Donald Trump to pay no taxes because of real estate deals. So isn't that where, I mean, shouldn't we have a hearing on that?
Well, I mean, if I were in charge of choosing the types of hearings that Congress could put on, we would be having a lot of much different discussions than are currently going on. That is certainly true.
So as much as you thought that they were off target there by taking advantage of this hearing to get the IRS commissioner on the record to point out that Donald Trump's excuse for not releasing his taxes is completely bogus, you were feeling that they should have really talked about this dark money loophole And that the legislation is sort of suspended, that the Republicans don't want to touch it, even though it's there for the taking. What's the next step? I mean, I know we're in a political season, but it looks like we're into, this is theatrics versus theatrics, right? Tea Party theatrics, huffing and puffing about some alleged jihad against the Tea Party by the IRS. And then you've got the Democrats shaming the Republican candidate, not that he can be shamed, about his taxes. So do you expect anything else for a while? I guess I assume we have to wait till after the elections for any serious business to be done, if at all.
Yeah, so it's even worse than that, actually, because the rulemaking that was going on that could have made the dark money nonprofit situation much better was going on sort of without Congress's involvement, and you know they IRS and Treasury accepted a bunch of public comments and were redrafting an original plan, and Congress, instead of letting that go forward, actively stopped it. And so now, you know, we have this provision in a spending bill that's likely to get renewed in any kind of continuing resolution that we now need Congress to remove. So I think we're just in a bit of a waiting game right now for the next administration and the next opportunity to remove this rider.
Well, Emily Peterson-Kazin, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
I did too. And again, I've been speaking with Emily Peterson-Kazin, who's a project coordinator of the Bright Lines Project at Public Citizen and an attorney who has worked in ERISA retirement and pension litigation. She spent most of today in a House hearing where the Republicans were attempting to impeach the IRS Commissioner, John Koskinen. Again, I'd like to invite you to the UC Hammer Forum tomorrow, Thursday, September the 22nd at 7:30 p.m., the new movement to end gun violence. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.